Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the escalating war between the White House and the special counsel, with Trump tweeting a warning today that, quote, "At some point, I will have no choice but to use the powers granted to the presidency and get involved." This following news of an apparent threat by Robert Mueller to subpoena President Trump and force him to testify before a grand jury. Since Trump's former lawyer John Dowd had tried to avoid his client testifying and quit last month, now the White House special counsel Ty Cobb, who has been urging the president to cooperate with Mueller, is also quitting, indicating a less conciliatory and more aggressive approach is underway. A former prosecutor with the International Criminal Court and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, Alex Whiting, a professor at Harvard Law School who is editor of Just Security, where he has an article, "What Mueller's Questions to Trump Reveal About the Future of the Russia Investigation," joins us. We'll discuss the latest shakeup of Trump's legal team and whether, now that Mueller's questions have been made public, it would be worse for Trump to contest having to testify before Mueller all the way up to the Supreme Court, and in doing so, appear even to his supporters to be hiding something. Then we'll assess Mike Pompeo's first trip abroad as Secretary of State and Trump's visit to the State Department today to show his support for Pompeo, who told the department's dispirited employees that he wants the State Department to get its swagger back. Stephen Walt, a professor of international relations at Harvard University and author of Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, joins us to discuss the extent to which Trump and Israel's Netanyahu appear to be laying the groundwork for the U.S. to pull out of the P5+1 deal with Iran on May the 12th. Then finally, we'll speak with Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent for The Week, where he has an article, "The Worthless Washington Media." He joins us to discuss how the indignant reactions to Michelle Wolf's biting comedy at the White House Correspondents' Dinner by the elite of the Washington Press Corps represents the reversal of the muckraking tradition of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. With the latest revelation of Mueller's questions to Trump emerging as a deliberate leak by the White House, we will examine the symbiosis between those in power and those covering them. And joining us now is Alex Whiting, a professor of practice at Harvard Law School, where he teaches, writes, and consults on domestic and international criminal prosecution issues. From 2010 until 2013, he was investigations coordinator at the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and prior to that was a U.S. federal prosecutor, first with the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division and then with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, where he focused on organized crime and corruption cases. He's also the editor of Just Security, where he has an article with Ryan Goodman, "What Mueller's Questions to Trump Reveal About the Future of the Russia Investigation." Welcome to Background Briefing, Alex Whiting.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And of course, the headlines today are the Washington Post story that apparently the special prosecutor had threatened, I guess it was the earlier lawyer who quit, Trump's lawyer who quit, John Dowd, about basically forcing the president or trying to coerce the president by saying that they'd subpoena him before a grand jury. But let's just go back to the big New York Times story that got a lot of attention, the 49 questions. We're learning that those questions were largely put together by Jay Sekulow, who is one of Trump's lawyers, who has a background in religious freedom issues in terms of the Christian right. So my first question would be, in terms of a caveat, how can we trust the veracity of those questions if they came out of the White House's office? And two, is it possible that this is an orchestrated leak by the White House in their, what appears to be, a brewing war with Robert Mueller?
Well, there's been some mystery about where the questions came from exactly and why they were leaked. The New York Times indicated that they were not leaked by Trump's legal team, but by somebody associated with the team. And there's been all kinds of speculation about why they were leaked. As far as their accuracy, it's hard to know for sure, though the reporting is that the questions are either directly from Mueller's camp, that's sort of the New York Times account, or the Washington Post account, which you've cited, which is that they're a compilation from made by Sekulow as a result of discussions with Mueller's attorneys. In either version, it seems as if they come from the Mueller side, either directly or indirectly, and they do reflect what we believe Mueller has been investigating. So whether they are precise in the particulars, they do seem to capture the kinds of things that Mueller has been investigating.
Well, apparently John Dowd quit over that very issue, that he thought the president would be a disastrous witness before the special counsel. And now we're learning that the other White House special counsel, Ty Cobb, is also quitting, and he's apparently been trying to act as a bridge between the special counsel and the White House, hoping to cooperate with them. So what do you take from that? Again, it looks to me like the White House is taking the gloves off and they're going to war against Mueller.
Yeah, well, you know, over the past weeks, Trump has alternated between a strategy and to some extent guided by his own instincts and also perhaps guided by his lawyers. He's alternated between, on the one hand, trying to accommodate the special counsel and try to get this thing wrapped up, and on the other hand, going to war and attacking him. And he seems to keep flipping back between these strategies and favoring lawyers who want to go one way at one time and then changing his mind and favoring lawyers who want to go the other way. And now it seems as if he's testing out the possibility of refusing to testify. He tweeted several tweets this morning which tracked the arguments that support him not testifying, that accusing the investigation of being a hoax, a trap, also talking about all the busy things that he has to do. These are all arguments that would be in support of him refusing to testify because of his special position as president. You can't impinge on his work and so forth and so forth. Most people think that if he were to refuse and it were litigated, that he would lose in court. But it might take some time, and so Mueller would have to make a decision about whether he wanted to embark on that battle, whether it was worth the several months that would be required to litigate the case, or whether he just wants to let it go and move forward. So that's a little bit the game that's being played here, the kind of negotiation that's going on between the two sides, between the Mueller camp and the Trump camp, trying to sort of feel each other out and see which way this is going to go.
Well, I don't mean to harp on the notion that there's a war brewing, and that does, at least I think it's on the record, but twice President Trump has talked about firing Mueller, apparently, and probably on both occasions, both Ty Cobb and John Dowd talked him out of it, or somebody else talked him out of it. So that's not to say that it hasn't been sort of swirling around for some time. What do you make of this Emmett Flood hire? My understanding is that Ty Cobb, who's now quitting, is the only member of the White House legal team that has security clearances, and Sekulow doesn't, apparently. So what about Flood? Is he's a real Washington insider, isn't he?
He is a Washington insider who has considerable experience with Washington investigations. He was part of the Clinton impeachment defense team, and he's represented Dick Cheney in the past and has enormous experience in this field. He is a huge asset to Trump's defense team, and make no mistake, Trump should have good legal defense. I think everybody's entitled to that, and it's important that these issues be litigated carefully. It's hard to know what to make of the hire in terms of strategy. Most people think that Emmett Flood is probably a more combative lawyer and will push back against the special counsel investigation more than other lawyers have, but Emmett Flood is so experienced that he also knows that sometimes it's important to push, sometimes it isn't. He doesn't have just one way of defending cases. he will assess the situation. I'm sure he'll get security clearance relatively soon, and he'll figure out what's best for his client. My guess is that there is going to be a kind of push and pull here. There's a little bit of just negotiating and posturing here, so it's hard to know how it ends up playing out. Trump is being more combative, but that may be to kind of get better terms for the interview. Trump knows, and his team knows that Trump would pay some political price for refusing to testify. And many people say that Trump is beyond paying any political price for anything, that he does whatever he does is outrageous, and his supporters still support him, and he never pays a political price for anything. That's true, but I have to say, I think that refusing to submit to an interview in a criminal investigation, it's not something that a president has ever done before, and I think that won't sit well with the American public and with many of his supporters. I think that if he ultimately refuses to testify, I think he'll pay a political price for that.
But you don't think it's possible that bringing Rudy Giuliani aboard could be a part of the strategy? We know the broader strategy for this longest time has been to discredit the FBI and the DOJ and essentially to, you know, shift the focus from you, Trump, and put it on the FBI and the DOJ and the deep state. And that seems to be working in terms of inside the Fox News bubble. So that's been going on for some time, but it seems to me that we're into a different round now where Giuliani is apparently negotiating with the special counsel, Mueller, who he knows and has worked with in the past. And is it possible that could be some kind of setup? In other words, to answer your question about the price he might pay for not showing up, if Giuliani were to say, well, you know, I tried and Mueller's an old colleague and clearly the special prosecutor is on a witch hunt, they're not flexible, they're not willing to compromise, and we simply can't deal with them or whatever. So is that possibly in the wind? That's my suspicion. I was very struck by Rod Rosenstein coming out and basically being quite combative and saying the Justice Department will not submit to extortion. And clearly, if Mueller had, as reported, had threatened to subpoena Trump before a grand jury, that probably would have been cleared by Rosenstein.
Right. So there are two things I would say. The first is that I think it's a mistake to presume that there is a single consistent strategy here. I think Trump never has a single strategy. He alternates in all kinds of situations between different competing strategies. That's the whole nature of his presidency, and it's at play here. And the fact that he has hired both Rudy Giuliani, who, as you say, is more the kind of guy who will try to smooth things over and try to develop a relationship with Mueller to do the interview, and Emmett Flood, who has more of a reputation being combative, shows how Trump is alternating between strategies. That's the first point. The second point is that you're absolutely right that if Trump ultimately decides not to submit to the interview, he and his lawyers are going to try to blame the whole thing on Mueller's team, that they were overreaching, that it was unfair, that it was a trap, that this is a witch hunt, that it's a hoax, it's distracting from important business. They will roll out all of those arguments. I don't think they'll work for this simple reason, that people in this country have a fundamental feeling that honestly, it's not always fair, but this is the reality, is that people think that if you have done nothing wrong, you should not have a problem talking to law enforcement and being interviewed by law enforcement. And if you refuse to talk to law enforcement, it's because you have something to hide. And people have now seen the 49 questions or the 49 areas of questionings. They can see that those are serious, that they're real, they're about real events. And if Trump has not done anything wrong, why doesn't he just answer the questions? And that there's something very fundamental about how people see that issue. And ironically, Trump himself has said that if anybody takes the Fifth Amendment, it means that they have something to hide. And those words will come back to haunt him. So I think he will overplay his hand here if he refuses to testify, and people, it will not sit right with people. Now, I've been wrong before in the last year about my political predictions, but here I think it will be different.
Well, what's your sense then, just in the last couple of minutes, of the timeline here? I mean, if Mueller wants to wrap this up, and he needs to do this interview with Trump in order to wrap it up, or at least to wrap up the obstruction of justice phase, when is something going to come out? I think that's obviously on everybody's mind in this election year. When is the hammer going to drop? And my understanding is that there's absolutely, under the way, it's not under the statute that Ken Starr operated under. So there's no timeline, there's no obligation to even make the report public. And what I sense Mueller has been doing is through these indictments, which are very thorough and very well written and very descriptive, we're learning about what's going on behind the scenes. So what would it take in terms of, short of releasing the report, which I don't know when that would happen, and I'm sure the Republicans are hoping it happens after the election, short of that, is there any big indictments that might rattle Trump and get our attention? I noticed in your piece that you, Alex, that you mentioned that you didn't think there was much in this, these 49 questions that would indicate that Jared Kushner's in trouble. But if somebody like him were indicted, what would it take, do you think, to break that sort of bubble between the Trump narrative, which is there's no collusion, this is a witch hunt, and the fact that there's been so much evidence out there of something's going on and we can't get to the heart of it, and this person, Donald Trump, is not behaving like an innocent person who would want to clear their name immediately. He never has from day one. So that compounds the suspicions that there's a there. But at this moment, we're in the Netherland, and I'm wondering when there'll be something concrete.
It's very hard to know is the short answer, but to elaborate on that a little bit, with respect to additional indictments, there's no way to know if there will be any additional indictments. And of course, the ones that would be, to your question about what kinds of indictments would break the bubble or would touch on this collusion matter, well, they would have to be indictments of senior officials close to the president who were involved in collusion. If Mueller crosses that the line and charges somebody like Kushner, like Donald Trump Jr., or like somebody else that is close to Trump with Manafort, for example, with collusion, with making some kind of a deal with the Russians to get their support during the campaign, that would be enormously consequential. That would put the collusion question front and center. With respect to the timeline, it seems that because Mueller is trying to interview Trump, he's come to the end probably of the obstruction investigation. Hard to know about the collusion investigation. So if the interview happens soon, the report that would be made to Rosenstein and then maybe made public, maybe made available to Congress, we don't know, would happen relatively soon. If Trump resists the interview and there's litigation, well, this could push it into the fall. And that would not favor Trump. The timing here doesn't really favor Trump, because then we could have this playing out during the midterm elections. Decisions from the courts, even from the Supreme Court, on whether Trump had to testify or not. So I actually think that the timing about the Trump interview works in Mueller's favor. Hard to know. These events could happen. Things could start happening in the next month or two, or it might not be until the fall. We just really don't know.
Well, Alex Whiting, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Alex Whiting, who's a professor of practice at Harvard Law School, where he teaches, writes, and consults on domestic and international criminal prosecution issues. From 2010 until 2013, he was investigations coordinator at the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and prior to that was a U.S. federal prosecutor, first with the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division and then U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, where he focused on organized crime and corruption cases. He's also the editor of Just Security, where he has an article with Ryan Goodman, What Mueller's Questions to Trump Reveal About the Future of the Russia Investigation. We can take a brief station break and back looking into Trump's show of support to Pompeo today at the State Department, where Pompeo told the dispirited employees that he wants the State Department to get its swagger back.
Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like this song?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Walter, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. He is the author of The Origins of Alliances, which received the 1988 Edgar S. Furness National Security Book Award, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Nice to be talking with you again.
Well, thank you, Stephen. And what did you make of the fact that after his first trip abroad, Mike Pompeo returned to the State Department, where today President Trump showed up to give him support and swear him in, and Pompeo told the State Department's dispirited employees that he wants the State Department to get its swagger back? What do you think that means?
Well, I have a sort of mixed reaction to that. There's no question that morale at the State Department is quite low. Former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was not popular, did not have any real rapport, had gone along with ideas for cutting the State Department budget. And so it's good that our new Secretary of State is at least trying to rebuild morale and telling the employees there that they're important and all of that. I would not have used the phrase swagger, however. I mean, I think that the job of diplomacy is not to swagger around the world telling other people what to do. You know, the Trump administration has already done too much of that, and they are hardly alone in that. But rather, we wanted to sort of send the message that the United States is fully engaged, but fully engaged in trying to work out problems with other countries in as cooperative a manner as we can. That's not always possible, but that should be our at least initial instinct. So swagger's not quite the word I would have used, but I hope he succeeds in rebuilding the department, giving it a more important role in U.S. Foreign policy, and finally restoring morale there.
Well, so your suggestion would be then perhaps we should have more of the Teddy Roosevelt idea of walking softly.
Yeah, exactly. Speak softly. You know, everyone understands the United States has a big stick, so you don't need to emphasize that very much. And if you think about it, over the last 25 years or so, the problems we have faced have not been due to a lack of swagger. The United States has thrown its weight around in a lot of places around the world, and not always very effectively. So again, a greater attention to a sort of more nuanced and sophisticated and collaborative foreign policy and less attention to swagger would probably be in our interest.
Well, speaking of swagger, it's hard not to refer to Prime Minister Netanyahu, who swaggered on the stage before the world press to announce that they had 100,000 documents from the Iranians, presumably through Israeli intelligence, that indicates that Iran had a secret nuclear weapons program. It's largely fallen flat on the world stage. In fact, it's been widely ridiculed, but it did feel like it had. The whole presentation was for an audience of one, President Donald Trump, who quickly tweeted that he agreed with Netanyahu 100%. But the amazing thing was that the White House put out a statement saying Iran has a robust clandestine nuclear weapons program that it had tried and failed to hide from the world and from its own people. And then they were shortly thereafter, they had to revise that. And the press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, yesterday blamed that on a typo, saying, well, the word has had to be changed to had. I mean, could we have World War III because of a typo? I mean, what kind of an outfit is that?
Well, there's several points to make here. First of all, as I think almost every objective observer has noted, there was really nothing new in what the Israelis revealed, what Prime Minister Netanyahu put forward. It was widely believed in the United States and elsewhere that at one point, you know, 15 or more years ago, Iran was doing some work that was related to nuclear weapons. Whether it was a really active, you know, full-bore program can be debated. But this is not a revelation. We understood that for a long time. And so in that sense, it was kind of a what, you know, Brits would call a damp squib. But the second point, and I think this is the more important one, is that, in fact, what Netanyahu was unwittingly doing was making the case for why the nuclear arrangement, what you might call the Iran anti-nuclear deal, is so important. The fact is, if you think Iran is untrustworthy, then it's much better for them to be under a series of agreements that prevent them from moving or doing any work on nuclear weapons, deny them the capability of building a nuclear weapon, and involve incredibly intrusive international inspectors and monitors to prevent them from cheating. In other words, the more unreliable you think Iran is, the more you ought to like the agreement that is currently in place, which we didn't have, of course, back 15 or 20 years ago when they were working on these various things. So the fact that nobody's taking Netanyahu seriously, I think, is not surprising. It is true that he may have been playing to an audience of one, President Trump, and, you know, if Trump decides to go along and move away from the nuclear deal, I think that's going to be an enormous mistake. Finally, it's just impossible to know whether or not this was a deliberate mistake in their messaging, you know, getting the tense of the verb wrong, or just sloppiness on the part of the White House, because this is a White House that has made mistakes like this repeatedly and is probably the least competent operation we've seen there in decades.
So it does seem that there's a kind of correlation, or the constellation is moving in such a way that it seems almost inevitable that on May the 12th, President Trump will announce that the United States is pulling out of the JCPOA, the so-called P5+1 deal with Iran. And Netanyahu has, of course, urged that for the longest time. And Trump has signaled, well, we know that anything that Barack Obama has done, he wants to undo, whether it's the last thing that Obama did, the deal with Cuba, which to all international scholars that I've talked to says makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. I mean, what was going on when that deal was struck with the Cubans was the very essence of what conservatives in America have always wanted, which is to encourage free enterprise in Cuba. And now the reverse is true. They're canceling all of the free enterprise licenses, etc., and the trade and tourism has dropped enormously. So that's seems to have makes no sense whatsoever geopolitically, but it only makes sense as a kind of petulant swipe at Obama. But this one's a big deal. And do you think the same kind of petty petulance is at play here? Or is there some fundamental reason why Netanyahu, Trump, and Pompeo want to get out of this deal?
Well, I don't understand. I can certainly understand why Israel is pushing this, although it's or Netanyahu is pushing it. Although it's worth noting that a very large number of Israeli national security experts, former national security advisors, former heads of the Mossad, and others have endorsed the deal and think we should stay in it. In this sense, Netanyahu is something of a minority even within national security circles in Israel. And the reason is pretty straightforward. You either have an international agreement like we currently have that keeps Iran from getting nuclear weapons, or if that agreement falls apart, then, of course, people in Iran who think Iran should have nuclear weapons are going to be strengthened politically because they tried to negotiate this. They got a deal with us and with our allies and with Russia and China, and then we, not Iran, we renege on the deal. This is going to strengthen the hands of people in Iran who say, what's the point of trying to cooperate with the West? And they're also going to say, look, if you want to get respect from the United States, get nuclear weapons. Do what Kim Jong-un has done. Go ahead, test a few nuclear weapons, test some missiles, and then you'll get the United States to agree to meet with you. You'll get the United States and others to start cooperating with you, and you won't have to worry about the United States trying to overthrow you. That's the argument Iranian hardliners will make. Well, if Iran does, in fact, start down the road towards a nuclear bomb again, then the United States has only two options. We either let that happen, in which case we have a nuclear-armed Iran, or we have to go to war with incalculable consequences. And I frankly don't understand what it is about that that the Trump administration can't figure out, that this deal, it may not be perfect in the sense that it didn't give us absolutely everything we ever wanted, and no deal ever does, but the alternatives to this arrangement are substantially worse. I might add one final thing is if we do walk away from the deal, then you know, Russia and China will still abide by it. Our European allies, Britain, France, Germany, will still abide by it. And we're engaged in essentially in an act of marginalizing and isolating ourselves, which, again, doesn't seem to make much sense to me.
Well, it's pretty clear that Trump just doesn't get it, that the deal was literally only about Iran's nuclear program and making sure that it doesn't move towards nuclear weapons. And that was its achievement. And there was no negotiations about side issues like Iran's activities in Iraq and Syria and with Hezbollah.
That's correct.
But that's what they keep talking about all the time, Netanyahu, Pompeo, and Trump. And what's ironic is, and what's totally inconsistent, is that the negotiation with North Korea and the summit upcoming is entirely about North Korea's nuclear program. It's not about their appalling human rights and their criminality of counterfeiting U.S. $100 bills and all the other activities that they're engaged in. So do you think Trump understands that, or just is he just looking for a public relations win?
I think that the latter is true to a large extent, that in a sense there's no coherence or strategic vision here. I think Trump, A, likes enormous amounts of attention, and he likes to be able to claim victories, whether they are victories or not. So, you know, I agree with pretty much everything you just said there. Now, there are certainly a number of issues that we would like to be able to raise with Iran and like to be able to discuss with them, and there would sticking with the agreement would not prevent us from then negotiating with Iran on any number of other things. But in fact, our position would be much stronger vis-a-vis Iran if we, and in conjunction with Russia, China, Germany, France, Great Britain, could sit down with Iran and say, all right, now look, we've got this nuclear deal. It's working. We're going to live up to our end of the bargain. You're going to continue to live up to your end of the bargain. That's great. Now, here's some things we want to talk to you about. That would be fine. That would actually be smart. We ought to recognize that if we do that, of course, Iran may have some issues it wants to raise with us. And that's, of course, precisely what's going to happen with North Korea, right? We have some issues we want to raise with them, primarily their missile tests and their nuclear weapons program. But they have some issues they're going to want to raise with us. And the question is, you know, who gets how much of what they want, or are we unable to reach any agreement at all? I guess my basic point is we would be in much better shape sticking with the Iran agreement, and then beginning to address the other issues we have with Iran, then getting out of the agreement, making it more likely that in the future we'll be bargaining with a nuclear-armed Iran as opposed to one that doesn't have nuclear weapons.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Stephen Walt, what happens, do you think, if the deal is made? It does seem that I'm talking about the Kim-Trump deal. It seems like both want it. There's a certain amount of similarity between the two, apart from their bad haircuts. They seem to be both fairly narcissistic. And in certainly Kim's case, he's considered, at least his people are programmed to consider him some kind of a god. I think I'm sure Donald Trump wishes we all thought he was a god, but only the people inside the Fox News bubble feel that way. But we know that he really has already been claiming credit. This deal's not even struck, and he's talking about, and he keeps talking about his predecessors and how he's got something to prove to them, and he clearly wants to show the world that he can do something better. So do you think this will reverse? Well, let me put it this way. Do you think this will really give him a boost, perhaps sufficient to get reelected in 2020?
Well, I don't think his election in 2020 is going to hinge on what's happening with North Korea, unless, of course, things have gone very badly and the negotiations fail, and then somehow we get into some kind of real conflict, which I think, by the way, would hurt him in a election in 2020. But I think one actually really needs to lower expectations a lot. I think it's very unlikely that you're going to see a complete breakthrough and that the United States is going to get everything it wants from North Korea. We keep claiming what we want is a complete, rapid, verifiable, inspected removal of North Korea's entire nuclear weapons program. And probably the dismantling of the infrastructure that created that, the various facilities they needed to enrich uranium and be able to build a bomb. We'd like, in other words, that all to be taken away. I think it's very unlikely that North Korea would do that because, of course, they don't trust us, and they would worry that once they had no nuclear capability, we might think about trying to overthrow them the way we overthrew, say, Muammar Gaddafi after he gave up his weapons of mass destruction equipment. What you may get is a more limited agreement where they say some nice words about each other, they talk about peace, and North Korea might agree to suspend its missile tests for some period of time while negotiations for a peace treaty continue, etc. That's, I think, the most one can expect out of a Kim-Trump summit. And then the real question is what happens between the two Koreas, because the South Korean President Moon and Kim Jong-un have had a meeting there that seemed to go well, and they're very interested in trying to lower tensions on the Korean Peninsula. We could, in fact, be in a situation where they do a better job of reconciling, and then more people in the Koreas start asking whether or not the United States should even be involved at all. That's something else that could come out of this once we've seen it all transpire.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, nice talking with you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, who's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, which received the 1988 Edgar S. Furness National Security Book Award, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. We take a brief station break. We're back looking into the indignant reactions to the comedian's biting comedy at the White House Correspondents' Dinner by the elite of the Washington Press Corps.
Ba, 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 ba.
Television rules the nation.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ryan Cooper, a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And he has an article at The Week, The Worthless Washington Media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Cooper.
Thanks for having me.
And in the last Gilded Age, given that we are in the new Gilded Age, that was a time when muckraking journalism was at its peak with Mark Twain and H.L. Mencken. I believe it was Mencken that coined the phrase that the job of the press is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And it seems like that paradigm's been turned on its head, particularly following the White House Correspondents' Dinner last Saturday night, with the choruses of indignation coming from the Beltway Press Corps about how rude the comedian was, and in effect defending Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who on a daily basis sneers at the White House Press Corps with absolute contempt. It's in her face, her posture, her countenance. Everything that she utters is barely disguised hatred and contempt. So why are they so indulgent towards this person who on a daily basis lies to them, sneers at them, and clearly despises them?
It's kind of a sociological question as far as I can tell, because I think one should be clear, it's really only a pretty small minority of journalists who actually think in this way. But they are very visible. There are a lot of the big-time political reporters, Maggie Haberman, Mike Allen, the people at Politico, and a lot of those type of people. And I think what they view themselves as basically part of the permanent Washington establishment. And in days past, it was more blatant, and there are even more people involved, more people who viewed themselves in this way. But what people end up doing is defending whoever happens to be in power, almost regardless of what they do. And there is a real, for a long time, suspicion of the idea that Nixon was personally corrupt, or that George W. Bush had made disastrous policy errors, or that he was lying to the public about Iraq and WMDs, or exaggerating the intelligence and that sort of thing. So, you know, I think these reporters are just sort of helplessly identify with power and whoever's holding it, even if, as really hasn't been the case before, the people who are in power and in their dealings with the press absolutely despise the press and would throw them all in jail if they could, probably.
I think Donald Trump actually said that, didn't he, in a discussion with another world leader?
It's hard to keep track of things on a day-to-day basis. It will not surprise me at all.
So at the moment, though, the big story is the one that the New York Times broke on the questions, the 49 questions that the special counsel wants to ask Donald Trump. And it turns out that these questions, as far as we know, were drafted by the president's lawyer, Jay Sekulow. And it seems pretty obvious, I think, that it was the White House who leaked this list of questions to the New York Times. And this has, of course, provoked an extraordinary amount of outrage coming from President Trump, who says it's disgraceful, etc. So how much do you think when it first broke, this story, MSNBC and others were just absolutely all over it and congratulating the reporters. But I'm not sure about how much kudos is deserved when you're being manipulated by the White House. This very people that you mentioned a minute ago hate you, and you're effectively being used. If indeed the leak did come from the White House, it certainly didn't come from special counsel's office, so there's not many other places it could have come from. So what's your reading on that?
Yeah, there's long been a real reluctance of people to, who in that sort of position, to burn their sources You can always make a news justification for publishing something like that, you know, a leak from a government official. And as you say, you do have to look at it in context of what you are doing as a sort of outlet of journalism. Like, for example, Dick Cheney used to do this routine where he would plant stories in the New York Times about Iraq's supposed WMD programs, and then he would go on Meet the Press and cite that New York Times story as being proof that it was coming from somewhere aside from the White House. And you would think that if someone in that position, you would just burn the source, you know, just be like, oh, you're going to use me like that? Well, I'm going to publish the fact that you are using me in this way. But, you know, I think these institutions, again, you know, sort of with the deference to power and the fear that they're going to get locked out of these scoops in the future, you know, that the New York Times is going to just be shut out from all contact with government officials, they generally seem to hesitate. You know, I can't even think of an instance when they've done that, especially to a really high-profile person, and given the likelihood is that in some, at least some of these instances, it's Trump himself who is the source. I would guess put quite a lot of money on that, or at least to, you know, his some pretty high-ranking people. So it's certainly not a banner moment in journalism when you see people getting played like that.
Well, it's not just that it looks as though the White House leaked these questions, which made front page news yesterday and still being talked about. And a lot of, particularly the TV journalists on MSNBC, were praising the New York Times reporters for essentially handing over a document that went through their hands. But nevertheless, there is this, I think, a real possibility that this is a part of an orchestrated plan on the part of the president to find a way to shut down the Mueller probe. And the fact that he voiced such indignation about how disgraceful the leaks were, if indeed they came from him or from somebody high up in his administration, would indicate that there is a kind of orchestrated plan afoot here. So the press in this case are being shamefully manipulated in an orchestrated way, aren't they? If there's a broader intention on the part of the White House, which there appears to be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly it seems totally non-credible that Mueller could have been the source for this, because that probe has been buttoned up tight to an almost unprecedented extent. You know, he has not leaked it, let a single thing leak until he's ready to roll somebody up. And I think it gets into another aspect of this whole situation, which is the fact that the Trump era has been wildly profitable for these big-time outlets. The New York Times is rolling up huge subscription numbers. They're more financially stable than they've been in a long time. MSNBC especially, they've been beating Fox News in the demo, as they say, the portion of the viewers, the advertisers, like people from like 18 to 40 or something like that. And that is just totally unprecedented. Like Fox News used to be double or triple or even quadruple MSNBC's ratings for decades almost. And, you know, I think you see there's a bit of doublethink going on in some cases, to where people, they're acting as though, and they are profiting off the fact that their left-leaning audience views Trump as this kind of incredible aberration, this historical monster who's undermining, you know, the national institutions, because he is doing that. But at the same time, you know, they kind of don't want the music to stop, because what if it's another boring person and people go back to not really paying that much attention or watching TV all the time? That might be bad for business.
Well, I don't know whether they're expiating for the fact that the mainstream press gave an estimate of $5 billion of free advertising to Donald Trump. And as we know, he spent much less on his campaign than Hillary did, and he's much more targeted on social media. But the fact that he got all that free media, do you think that's what's going on? There's a certain amount of expiating? Because I noticed that one of the barbs from the comedian on Saturday night before the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Michelle Wolf, I think she was talking about CNN, but she basically said, you know, you guys are profiting from this catastrophe.
Yeah, that's she is 100% correct about that. And I think people are certainly being quite squirrely about this, reality, which is maybe to be somewhat fair to these the more serious print journalism outlets is certainly driven in part by the fact that they were almost, you know, they've been almost tottering on the edge of going out of business since like the year 2000 due to, you know, collapsing print revenue and all their ad money being eaten by Facebook and Google. But at the same time, you know, like there is such a thing as ethics. And I wouldn't say, it seems to me that the reporters are taking it seriously in general, you know, your sort of beat reporters. But a lot of these big time sort of national names, the people who are on cable news all the time and, you know, really prominent type of folks are the managers and editors and owners are, they're trying to play it both ways, I should say. And it's not very subtle the way they're doing it.
Well, it was CBS's Les Moonves that let the cat out of the bag, saying Trump may not be good for America,
yeah,
but he's really good for CBS. I think that sort of says it all. But I recall the Stephen Colbert roast of George W. Bush. It was particularly effective. And again, there was a great deal of discomfort in the room because Colbert was basically attacking the press for being George W. Bush's lapdogs. And clearly the tone was, this guy is so easy to make fun of and what he's doing is so absurd. How come you people aren't screaming from the rafters? And the same thing I think is true. It's even worse under Trump because this is the most insane presidency we've ever had. And it's so obvious this guy doesn't know what he's doing and is dangerous and ignorant and perhaps mentally unstable. And I thought one of the more effective jokes, again, in that idea of pointing out the absurdity of the situation was when Michelle Wolf said that she supports Trump's plan to arm teachers because that way they can sell their guns and buy school supplies. I mean, that really, that to me, that's some of the best political journalism or whatever you want to call it, because it really gets to the heart of the insanity and the absurdity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the great, you know, what political comedians are supposed to do. You know, they're supposed to use humor to point out these kind of uncomfortable facts. And this is, you know, this is a background reality that we're seeing in a lot of places for the first time in very surprising locations, in West Virginia and Oklahoma and Arizona. You know, these really red states where suddenly, you know, public employees are revolting over the, you know, the fact that they, in many cases, literally can't make ends meet with the salaries that are being paid. And education in particular has been severely cut in these red states over the last decade. And that kind of, you know, is a background to all of this that, you know, the big time media outlets are also having trouble with, which is that, you know, Trump ran on as a sort of, you know, right-wing populist, we're all going to get trade jobs, we're going to stop giving them to China and Mexico, and everybody's going to be prosperous again. And the elite press has been very resistant to that, to the idea that there was any sort of actual kind of logical reasoning behind some of the Trump support, to think that, like, well, maybe if I vote for Trump, I'll get a better deal in my life or something. And instead, you know, it's all about this sort of lumpen proletariat that's just like pure hatred of women and black people. And, you know, I think every day there's a new reminder that, yeah, you know, and this people are suffering in this country. And it is nice to see a comedian sort of bring that out, sort of rub it in people's faces, even if they don't, you know, even if it's not funny. Maybe especially if it's not, they don't think it's particularly funny.
Right. Her parting line when she finished her riff at the White House Correspondents' Dinner on Saturday night was, "And the people in Flint still are drinking poisonous water." And I thought that was a real zinger, reminding us all. But during the campaign, the Huffington Post tried to not report on Trump because they thought he was so crazy and so absurd and so embarrassing. when he was doing the reality TV thing of knocking all the other Republican candidates off the island. And, of course, very shortly thereafter, they had to keep covering him. So that raises the question of how do you navigate this? Because I think if you take Trump seriously, then you are normalizing him. And that seems to be a fatal mistake. If people recognize the reality, or the press recognize the reality of this aberration from day one, I don't think we'd be in such bad shape. But as long as he's normalized, and he obviously is in this extraordinarily exalted office, so it's hard not to normalize him. But how do you think that can be achieved? In other words, not to take him seriously and to avoid normalizing him?
Well, that's a tricky question. The time to not do that would have been in the primary, and I think the story that these media people, the executives in particular, told themselves was that, well, it's okay to give Trump endless free coverage because he's definitely not going to win. There's that famous scene where Maggie Haberman, of all people, has actually laughed in Keith Ellison's face on This Week with George Stephanopoulos when Ellison suggested that Trump might win the primary, and they are just all guffawing at him. Now that he's president, though, I think that the normalization ship has kind of sailed to some extent. As president, sort of whatever he does is a normal, a presidential behavior, sort of by definition. So I think the thing that I would, if I were trying to be an ethical media executive, I would try to treat him in a proportional politician style of coverage as I possibly could, to just be like, think of him, try to imagine he's Andrew Cuomo or somebody like that, and just give him that much coverage, more or less. And I'm sure that would be really hard, because it's just ratings crack. But, just trying to balance out, like I remember this multiple times during the campaign when Bernie Sanders, for example, or even Hillary Clinton sometimes would be giving a speech, and she'd be like in the middle of the speech, and CNN was notorious for this, especially they would have an empty stage where Trump was going to give an address, and they would just leave it there, and they'd have their talking heads speculating about what he's going to say or something like that. Just trying to milk every last drop out of that Trump coverage. And I think that's the behavior to really avoid, because that's when you start getting into the just absurd free propaganda value and the, excessive normalization that you're talking about.
Well, Ryan Cooper, I thank you for the conversation. I'm not sure that we solved these incredibly difficult problems that we have. Covering Trump feels like the daily dose of doom. And you know that you're being manipulated, because much of what he's doing is deliberately to distract people from the fact that he's totally out of his depth and doesn't know what he's doing. So it's one of those situations where you're sort of like in the movie The Wizard of Oz. You're just waiting someday somebody to pull the curtain back, and every day that goes by, more damage is done to the Republic and the world. So God help us. I thank you for joining us, Ryan.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Cooper, who's a national correspondent at The Week, whose work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. And he has an article at The Week, The Worthless Washington Media. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.